Today on the Radio Cafe, we're celebrating Human Rights Day. December 10th was proclaimed Human Rights Day by the UN General Assembly back in 1950. It was meant to inform people that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights would be the common standard of achievement for all people in all nations. Later in 1993, the UN established the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights that was meant to promote and protect all human rights. And this was all in response to recommendations from a World Conference on Human Rights held in Vienna. So today, December 10th, 2013, is the 20th year since this office has been established. According to the UN, there's been significant progress, specifically in the advancement of women's rights, development of international law to achieve accountability for human rights abuses, greater protection of the rights of marginalized groups, and in general, a better understanding of what they call the universality and indivisibility of human rights. So as we all know, human rights continue to be violated just about every day and in every country. We have no illusions on this. And yet today we're here to celebrate some of the achievements that have been made toward human rights. We have several special guests with us, all of whom participated in a recent storytelling session here in Santa Fe that was centered around civil and human rights. The session was led by Joe Lambert. He is the chief listener and convener for the Center for Digital Storytelling based in Berkeley, California. He's here with us today, as are some of the Santa Fe participants, including Judy Goldberg, executive director of the Youth Media Project, and Lucy Moore, author of the book Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator. Welcome, all of you, to the Radio Cafe, and happy Human Rights Day.
Thank you, Zaylee.
It's great to be here.
I am really excited to be listening to the short recordings that all of you made recently. I think it was about 2 months ago. But first, I would really love to hear a bit about the process. And Joe, I would like to start with you and have you describe your work and then how this recording project came to Santa Fe.
Yeah, I run the center based in Berkeley. It's a national organization that works in storytelling and various forms of new media, but we're mainly known for helping people make these short personal videos called digital stories. And over the years, we've had the pleasure of working with lots of organizations engaged in, you know, the struggles for human rights and civil rights in various community contexts and sometimes on, you know, larger national and international levels. In the last period, we had been very interested in taking a model of our work that would allow us to kind of come into communities and do very intense little, you know, 4 to 6 hour workshops working with people. And a campaign we launched on Martin Luther King Day, or on the, you know, 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice on August 28th, we launched this national project to visit communities and have them share stories about civil and human rights, with the idea that we were bringing, if you will, the generation of Trayvon Martin and the current struggles for civil and human rights and voting rights, many of the same struggles are going on today, with those generation of veterans of the civil rights movement who are getting to the stage where their stories are being lost. And so we wanted to bring generations together to share those stories. And as it happened, I got a chance to visit my old friend Judy Goldberg in Santa Fe and convinced her that we should organize a little workshop to have people sharing their stories of human rights. And it was an amazing collection of people and an amazing collection of stories. So I felt, you know, really honored to be there and obviously just enjoyed hanging out with Judy at the, I want to say Project 21 Center, but it's the
Warehouse 21.
Center. Warehouse 21 Center, lovely center.
This, and listeners will be able to hear the recordings that you all did on that day, but you also have a website, cowbird.com, where people can go and listen to all sorts of recordings. I mean, you started this 20 years ago as an educational tool, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're partnering. The storycenter.org is the home site of the Center for Digital Storytelling. Cowbird is a colleague of ours developed this wonderful one image and a story website a couple of years ago this December, and We began using it as a place, as a venue for sharing stories. It works great for these kinds of writing meets a single image approaches, and they helped us build out a special section of the website dedicated to this All Together Now project, as we're calling this National Intergenerational Civil and Human Rights Story Project.
And to date, about how many participants do you have from across the country?
Yeah, we did 11 workshops, and it came in at about 89. You asked me yesterday, and I asked the staff member who's coordinating, and she says we've come in at 89 stories from the 11 workshops. So we didn't get quite 10 people per workshop, which was our goal, but we got close to it, and they really, you know, are a range of stories. But, you know, part of our idea is this is a very early pilot of a project that will allow for, you know, much larger participation and sharing and exchange of these kinds of stories. It was just an opportunity for us to, you know, reconnect with lots of people in lots of communities across the American South, on the East Coast, and down there in New Mexico.
And before we launch into some of the stories, can you talk a little bit about the impact that storytelling, well, that you feel that storytelling has, and really the impact that you've seen in with a lot of the people that you've worked with on this and other stories?
Well, I mean, I think for anybody that listens to contemporary radio, we've seen, you know, a movement, if you will, from the documenter, who is an expert storyteller who shapes the story and, you know, as a reporter, a journalist, a documentary radio person, filmmaker, to stories where we like to have as little intervention as possible. Maybe the classic now being, having just celebrated the 10th anniversary of StoryCorps, being an intimate, you know, kind of listening into an intimate conversation between two people, unmediated in a sense by a producer at all. And we've, you know, seen that this change in an authentic voice, kind of direct storytelling from the heart of a person who had an experience to the hearts of the listeners has become very effective and very powerful. And, you know, I've referred to it as a story revolution, which in some ways to me is part of the exact same revolution that is trying to undo the damage of consumer capitalism in relationship to the way we eat, the way we exercise, the way we connect to each other, the way we approach spirituality. All of this is the same movement toward wholeness. And story for us is just the metaphor of kind of healing yourself through what you know already. And particularly if you've experienced trauma, healing yourself by facing, if you will, the dragon of that trauma and staring in the eye and telling stories about it in order to take control of the story instead of the story taking control of you. So story work is, you know, it's a rich field right now, and never been more people interested and involved in helping capture stories and listening between people. And I'll say that as a final thing. I think so much of this work is about a noisy media world where everybody's talking and nobody's listening. And I think, as you'll hear about the process we used in Santa Fe, the heart of it was a circle of people just stopping and hearing each other talk. And stories that then are created out of that experience go to much greater depth because the listening process is in much the way what we teach, not the storytelling process.
Well, I think that's a perfect note to launch into the first story, and this is by Lucy Moore.
The car door slammed, and Ronnie was gone. I sat in the backyard with my parents, frozen and numb. He had come to live with us 11 months ago when he was 7 and I was 10. He was my brother. We walked to school together, his little hand in mine. We played and laughed, and now it was over. My parents had decided that Ronnie's psychological problems were too much. So Miss Wilson, the social worker, came and took him away. I couldn't grasp it. What kind of family kicked someone out because he had a problem? What would happen to Ronnie? Would I ever see him again? Did he know that I wanted him to stay? Did he know that I loved him? Would I be next? Years later, I was facilitating a large public meeting about a proposed copper mine in rural northern Arizona. The crowd of 300 had a lot to say. The mine would cause air pollution, drive away tourists, hurt wildlife, and more. After 5 hours, I was sure we had heard everything. Scanning the crowd, I asked, "Is there anyone else who has a new issue to bring up?" From the front row came a tentative hand. An elderly woman stood up. "Yes, dear, I'm worried about the visitors." I struggled to place this concern in the mass of flip chart notes on the wall. "Are you talking about the impact on tourism? We talked about that earlier." "No, dear, I'm talking about the visitors." Still confused, I asked if she meant family members that might come to visit her. "No," she said again. And then I looked at her upraised hand with her finger pointing skyward, and I understood. So did many of the audience who were smirking and watching to see how I was going to handle this. "Oh, I think I understand," I said. "You are worried about those who might be visiting from another planet and what they might see." "Yes, that's right," she said brightly. "I don't want them to look down and see a big scar on our beautiful planet." I wrote on the flip chart a new topic, interplanetary concerns. She nodded approval. I was not going to let any voice, no matter how different, be excluded. No one was going to be sent away. And the only sound of car doors slamming would be at the end of the meeting.
So, Lucy, can you tell us where that story came from?
That story came from very deep inside of me. It's one of those formative experiences that we have all had in one form or another early in our lives. And I think the funny thing is that I did not plan on telling that story when I came that morning to Warehouse 21. But Joe gave what I thought was going to be a kind of perfunctory introduction of what we were going to be doing. In the meantime, I, of course, was planning my brilliant story. And then I began to realize what he was saying, and it sunk in that he was really driving me in the direction of another story, not the one I had planned to tell. And this, the way he spoke about formative events and things that have stuck with you and really, and I thought, oh, this is the story I have to tell about Ronnie leaving our family. And so I did tell that one, and then later the process was that we had to write the story down and then condense it, which was the hard part, into what you just heard, into a very short period. So I'm very grateful that that he did dig that story out of me, and also that it ended up linking to what I do for a living, which is a mediator. And I really now realize the importance for me of being a mediator and listening to and encouraging everybody else to listen to every single voice, that there is no voice that does not belong at the table. There is no story that does not deserve to be told. And so for me, it was a really profound experience that day, and I'm grateful to Judy and to Joe for making it happen.
I think you really touch on that kind of universal need also for everyone to be heard. I mean, not only does every person have a story, but just acknowledging them, that acknowledgement sometimes is all people need. And I think that we lose that a lot through technology, through lack of communication. So that's what it really brought up for me, this kind of universal idea of acknowledging everyone and as you say, listening to their stories and including them.
Exactly, and not judging. You know, how easy is it for us to immediately leap to a conclusion, oh, that woman is out of her mind. She's thinking about Martians looking at the planet. That's not what we're here for. I mean, we do not have the right to make that kind of judgment. She cared passionately. She cared enough to come to that meeting, and she had something to contribute, and it needed to be honored. And if we could all do that more, I think our human rights situation in the world would inevitably be better.
Do we want to move on to the second one? This is by Vina Vasista.
I was 27 years old when my boss, Mark, said he was thinking of firing me. He explained, "Jason wants me to fire you, says you can't be trusted." I was working for a black organization based in London. Black was a political term of solidarity we used to refer to anyone who wasn't white. Born and raised in the suburbs of Chicago, the daughter of Indian immigrants, I had started this job 8 months earlier. "I thought," Mark continued, "coming from Chicago, you would be more Malcolm than Martin." The previous week, we had had a meeting. Part one involved black activists coming together to determine our agenda for collective advocacy around long-awaited human rights legislation, which was making its way through a newly elected Labor Parliament. The second part involved established human rights leaders, who were all white, coming to join the meeting. These people had been campaigning for decades, in various capacities, to get this human rights law on the table. Mark welcomed our afternoon guests and then said something like, "We all know how racist your organizations are." Two of the guests didn't seem to mind this remark. You could see the face of another one tense up, and another looked confused and stunned. I felt a wave of shock run through my body as I rocked in my seat and Mark continued speaking. He was going to segue into the discussion when I intervened, saying something like, "Before we continue, I'd like to say that our guests have been really helpful to me in my efforts to get the human rights program up and running. I'm grateful for their support." For the trustee, Jason, this meant I couldn't be trusted. For my boss, Mark, it meant I wasn't radical enough. I went on to run that human rights program for 3 years, while we jokingly came to call me the office's token white liberal. While I have never come to agree with what my boss did at that meeting, I came to understand why he did what he did and why he didn't like my reaction. 15 years later, looking back, I now see that we were both seeking to do the same thing in radically different ways.
Judy, I would love to bring you in just to comment on how you brought together this group of individuals, because each story, now we've gone through two, but they're all so dynamically different, and it's a really wonderful group.
Yes, and you're soon to hear many more that adds to the diversity. Well, I put out the big net, I guess, in terms of this opportunity when Joe called like a week and a half prior to the workshop. There wasn't actually a flutter, a pause in my system. Of course we were going to do this, and of course it was going to happen in some beautiful form, and so it did. So having a collection of people through Youth Media Project and when I used to do Backroads Radio shows, I just sent out an email to as many people as I could saying, "This is what we have going on. There's the opportunity to tell a story, to come with a story for one day, work with the amazing Joe Lambert from the Center for Digital Storytelling, and go into your own personal archive and see what story you have about civil and or human rights." And that called up the people that came forward on that day, the seven people that walked in the door, and Joe led us through a process that I think we all pleased to have gone through.
Let's jump into the story by Jeff Haas, and we'll continue.
I was driving home with friends in Atlanta when we noticed headlights closely following us. Somehow we ended up in a wooded area. When we stopped, the car behind us pulled up close, and several teenage guys about our age got out. "Get out, you Jew bastards," the first one yelled. "You are nothing but kikes and Jew dogs. Chicken shits." I'd never encountered anything like this. I looked to my cousin Mike, who had bullied me and the rest of us, to see how he would respond. "Let's get out of here," he said urgently in my ear, clearly as frightened as the rest of us. No bravado that night. I didn't need any prodding. I jerked the steering wheel and somehow maneuvered the car away and past the guys still shouting. Even as I drove away, I regretted our failure to confront these anti-Semitic bullies. Years later, I used my law degree to represent the progressive and most radical movements in Chicago, including the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, and SDS Weathermen. Part of my motivation was to stand up to injustices, not as a street fighter, but as a lawyer representing people in confronting power. In August 1969, Fred Hampton, the Young Black Panther leader, was speaking at the People's Church, and my law partner, Flint Taylor, and I were among the few whites present. In the middle of his very passionate speech, Fred Hampton told everyone in attendance to rise and raise our right fist. I followed his direction. "Now repeat," he said, "I am," and we all said, "I am." "A revolutionary," he shouted. I couldn't say it. The word stuck in my mouth. I considered myself a lawyer for the movement, but not necessarily of the movement. Fred repeated his directions, and the crowd responded, louder each time. By the third or fourth time, it came from me. "I am a revolutionary." 2 months later, Flint and I were telling the press and world that the Chicago police had murdered Fred in his bed, and we were determined to expose his killers. A legal and political fight that took us 13 years.
Well, that was Jeff Haas, and Jeff actually has come out with a book all about Fred Hampton that I believe, I have not read it, but Joe, are you still with us?
Yeah, of course.
You can speak to.
Yeah, no, I mean, Jeff was at the center of probably the most dramatic piece of extrajudicial, you know, murder between the Chicago police, the FBI, COINTELPRO, CIA of Fred Hampton. And to have somebody like that in the workshop, in many ways, in the center of one of the great historical battles for civil and human rights, was amazing. And Jeff's book is a deeply personal document of being a young lawyer in the middle of Chicago politics and Chicago community activism at a level of, you know, that few of us can imagine. This was the era of the 68 convention and Abby Hoffman and lots going on in Chicago when he was there, and he was in the middle of it. And that story, I think, is just a reminder to, you know, that whether we're talking about Trayvon Martin or what seems to be an unending number of extrajudicial style murders, either by the police or by the, you know, people that are so supposedly guarding us in this overarmed state we live in. This, you know, this idea that the right to just be alive is not a given. And that struggle seems to continue for young, you know, and very particularly young black men like Fred Hampton at age 21, gunned down in his bed. So to me, a very powerful story and a reminder of the, you know, very complicated history that many people in the 60s had to go through, a very painful and often dark history.
And also these profound experiences. I mean, as you say, these formative moments. I mean, that's what's so interesting about it. Jeff has really, he's come so far and has really embraced this and has fought for righteousness in so many ways. And to boil it down to these moments, these singular moments in one's life when you are struck with fear or you see racism, this kind of blatant racism right in your face, and that kind of partly feeds into the way you live the rest of your life. I think that's amazing to hear. I would like to move on. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that the point is well taken. We see it, we see the world in mental pictures, and when we're taken to a moment, we're standing right there with Jeff as Fred Hampton saying, "I am." And we can imagine ourselves right at that moment, as well as we can imagine being chased by Georgia rednecks as a Jewish young man. Obviously, that's the important lesson about telling a good story is you need to show and not tell, and those moments do that. They bring us into the moment with the character, and it's very powerful.
I'd like to follow that with Ursula Muller.
Our family had fled Vienna in 1938 after the Anschluss, when I was 4 months old. We felt blessed to be among those who escaped and found refuge in England. 2 years later, there was a hammering on our front door. The British Constabulary announced that they were going to take away my father, a research chemist at Cambridge University. They gave him 1 hour to get his things together. Without a word, they took him away. Another hammering at the door 2 weeks later. They gave my mother 1 hour to prepare to leave with me. A visiting friend emptied his wallet for her. She stuffed the money in her girdle. She tells of distorted faces yelling epithets at our train that took us to the internment camp. Hundreds of Austrian and German women and children, recent immigrants, were placed behind barbed wire and armed guards in the Balquhiny Hotel on the Isle of Man. My non-English-speaking grandmother arrived 1 month later. I know my mother spent hours washing the sheets of our shared bed where I peed nightly. She walked the beach when allowed and gathered shells. A fellow internee made them into a necklace, which my mother wore often until her death. She bequeathed the necklace to me. My mother, a model internee, was sometimes allowed to shop in the village, accompanied by armed guards. She was chosen to play the part of Mary in the Christmas play for the camp. We were released after 10 months and returned to our home in Cambridge. After the war, we immigrated to the USA. I heard bits and pieces of this story from my mother over 90 years, but only when I asked. How did it affect me? Every day I felt I was lucky, lived life to its fullest. It took her death to start me writing our family memoir. I felt an obligation to my family, her especially. I wanted my children and grandchildren and beyond to know our story, but one of thousands. I have spent 30 years working with disadvantaged inner-city children in Syracuse. It has fed me as much as them and their families. My mother was proud of me all those years.
Whew, boy. You know, Joe, you and I spoke yesterday also about the intimacy of these stories and also the intimacy shared by a group of people who gets to hear these stories. I mean, not only in the recording session, or rather, I think especially in the recording session, because you're in this room together and you're really thinking through the process. And can you talk a little bit about that kind of intimacy and how you help people go into that very personal moment?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things we've learned is you know, and I think it was said earlier, that the respect of a person's being is something you can model as a facilitative leader, and it's demonstrated by your whole body listening. And when you experience that sometimes, where a group of people realize that the game that's on is we're demonstrating massive amounts of loving kindness toward a person as they're talking to us, that the person actually goes through a kind of rethink of what it's all about. You know, meaning any story has for us an insight that's about this moment, about the changes that we still have to go through as a human being. And what happens is you drop in to the vulnerability that makes you profoundly human to other humans. It's the point at which you tip from being a stranger to being somebody that you can hold in terms of your protection of them, of your sense of endearment to them, of your connection to them. And in those moments of deep listening, people's stories change, and they often can come out of that process writing things they weren't intending to write or talking about things they weren't intending to talk about. And it stays with them, you know, before, if you will, the superego can kick back in and sort of say, wait, do I really want to share that? And inevitably, with all these stories, we don't publish them. I mean, we're not a publishing organization. We're kind of, you know, facilitation organization. We don't publish the stories immediately because people may want to reconsider the intimacies mm-hmm. they shared. Certainly when we're working with human rights stories across the planet, there are times that people put themselves at risk talking about the stories, and they need to decide that they're ready to have their story represent a community or represent a narrative, and are they willing to carry the burden of that as well as the, you know, the whole lifting or the celebrity or the connections, the larger connections that they make, they help other people. To me, it's very important that we listen through the process to get people to talk as directly to their own need as possible, to their own story as possible, and then decide that, yes, in fact, this is the story that's important for me to share, and I want to share it. And we did have, you know, at least one example where the person was really not quite ready, and they needed to go away and do a little work to kind of position the story that they felt comfortable in being public. Because in this particular process, unlike many of our processes, the expectation was a publication. We were going to share these stories publicly. But I think for us, it's really important to protect storytellers in any number of environments from that kind of exploitation, a kind of emotional pornography that I think we can accuse the media of being in the business of. And that is not what we're trying to do. We're trying to get people to feel what's important, calibrate it for a public presentation, and be surprised with the fact that, in fact, a broad audience can hold their story and that they're and find them very meaningful and important, because most of us just don't believe they are.
And I would assume also to inspire others, right? I mean, this is the point, that if this person can be as emotionally vulnerable, then you can too. I mean, it certainly makes you think of your own stories and your own moments as you go through it. It's, again, that human connection.
There's no question that courage begets more courage. You know, that when somebody says, oh, crap, I'm going to talk about this thing that I haven't talked about, everybody in the room kind of recalibrates their expectations of what they have inside themselves that they know for sure needs to be told, and maybe they hadn't told it. But once they do, it changes their relationship to the thing. And, you know, a whole lot of therapeutic processes now are just people listening to you telling the darkest, darkest, hardest moment of trauma. It's just, instead of walking away from it, you walk toward it until you grab it, you look at it, you can hold it, you can shape it in a different way and put it up on a shelf and say, that story is something that happened to me. It's not me. It's different. And I think in the context of human rights work, that is the essential important part of the listening storytelling process in our culture, is that we have to learn to be storytellers who can, you know, let a story go and not have it tell our lives anymore. We can tell the story.
I should remind our listeners, this is Human Rights Day, December 10th, and we are listening to Joe Lambert. He's the chief listener and convener for the Center for Digital Storytelling. I also have Judy Goldberg, Executive Director of the Youth Media Project, and Lucy Moore here in the studio. They all participated in this recording project. You will hear it here. It will be recorded. You can also go online. Joe, can you tell us where we can go again to listen to these and so many other people's stories about civil rights?
Yeah, you could simply Google up in the way that most of us do it, the Calbird All Together Now. All Together Now is a campaign. Calbird.com is the website where the amalgamation of this particular project around human rights and civil rights intergenerational conversations is taking place. but you'll also find thousands of other wonderful stories, and you can actually engage yourself in that community as a storyteller. We hope in the spring that you can add your stories to what Talbert calls a saga about the issue of freedom or protest related to this topic.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we have three more pieces to listen to, so please don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe. We are here with Joe Lambert from the Center for Digital Storytelling, based in Berkeley. We also have Judy Goldberg, Executive Director of the Youth Media Project, and Lucy Moore, author of the book Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator. It is December 10th, Human Rights Day, and we are listening to stories that were recorded here in Santa Fe by Joe Lambert. We've listened to three, and we are now going to listen to one by Jeroge Tobias.
Little Grandma is what I was told to call her. Her hands were the introduction to her life of woe. My great-grandmother, Carrie, and her husband, Joshua Summers, had moved from Vicksburg, Mississippi to Louisiana to Kansas City, Missouri, following wherever the work was. They always brought their work with them, a grocery store that would be set up in their living room. My first memories are of the big 24-room old three-story Victorian home at 2104 Forest Avenue, near downtown Kansas City, Missouri. There was no grocery store in the living room. Life had been good to my great-grandparents, who had worked hard in their previous home grocery store, and over the years, they had managed to save enough money to buy the house that I knew them to live in and employ the drivers of the four or six dump trucks that lined the long driveway along the side of their house. Inside, there was a large entry vestibule. Just before my eyes, about 30 stairs leading to the second floor bedrooms. Clad in only a diaper, I made my way up the long staircase. I made a beeline up the stairs to see little Grandma Emma, a farmer's slave. When I got to the top of the stairs, I peered directly into little Grandma Emma's room, where she was lying on a cot-like bed. On a small round table next to the bed, there was a cup of hot tea and a saucer with three or four crackers on it. She beckoned me into the room. I crawled in and drew near to her bed. Little Grandma Emma said, "Come here, baby. You can drink the tea I have and have the crackers." I remember staring at her crippled hands as she handed me the teacup. I looked at all of her fingers that pointed in different directions. Our eyes locked in silence. Her sweet, soft, and slowly spoken voice unraveled the story of how she was the only slave on the plantation one day who was able to read and write and available to take a note to the next neighboring plantation to request a loan of supplies. The wife of the plantation owner was faced with a dilemma. With her husband gone, her two little girls at school, and no one at the neighboring plantation able to read the note that she had written. Hearing this, while assisting the missus in the kitchen, little Grandma Emma, as a little girl, yelled out, "I can read and write. Mrs. Daughters taught me after they came from school every day." With great disgust, the missus ordered little Emma to the kitchen table, where she proceeded to break each and every finger with a hammer. Cupping my face in her hands, she said in a clear voice, "We are not to blame them. If they knew better, they would do better."
This is such an incredible story. And I just have to say to everybody that just heard it, and I know how you feel because we're feeling it the same way here in the studio, but if you had been there when Jaroge told it, you would have seen the most amazing face and person telling this story, full of love, full of a lifetime of generous teaching. He's been a teacher and an educator his whole life. And to hear, you know, where he came from, to hear the history that he was born into and that molded his life is just really, really incredible. And it was a wonderful experience to be there in person. So I applaud Joe and the Digital Storytelling Project, and it's great to have all these recorded, but oh man, you really missed something to not see Jaroge tell this in the flesh. It was really something.
And I think that is so much what our work is about. I mean, we do it within a circle of people. But the hope certainly is that circle widens when these stories are recorded and told. And I have to say that when Jaroge told his story, because he was right before, and this is part of how the process went, where we all went around and had maybe 10 minutes to talk about the story idea that we were thinking to craft for this very reduced down version. And in his telling his story, it actually freed me to tell a story that I had just freshly gotten the information about. It was still rattling around in my own system because I had not really understood how I had participated on the other side of injustice. You know, as many of us don't see when we're young that we may be participants and perpetuators of something. And I also have to say that in the story that is about to play, I really see it within a context of a time period and how our different frames of mind can justify things, can actually think that things are fine and that we are helping people. And I think that for me, the complexity of that the story that I will be telling, it was still very jumbled in me of where I sat with it. And again, it's you enter into this work at different stages of development in understanding your own story and the stories that you're telling. So for me, this story is still somewhat raw. However, I think it was important to tell because it's, again, another unfolding of the story of human rights, human struggle, and the human condition.
Well, with that, let's listen to the story by Judy Goldberg.
My grandfather was rounded up and taken to a Polish police station after standing guard at a Jewish Socialist Party meeting. Being told to wait and anticipating what would be his punishment, he walked out of an open door and subsequently was ushered out of Warsaw by friends and family. My grandparents met in San Francisco, married, and joined the Petaluma Chicken Farmers, a well-known socialist Jewish community. My grandmother hated living in the country, and they moved back to San Francisco, where my grandfather started a furniture manufacturing company. We would visit my grandparents in their plush home on the peninsula. French Victorian furniture, porcelain figurines, a hula-hula Hawaiian figure, and the ever-enchanting dark wooden cuckoo clock. Hanging chimes and a pendulum ticking off the seconds till the cuckoo birds sang. Passover gatherings were a blur of my grandmother's operatic voice, the grand baby piano, and the formal dining room. After reading from the Haggadah, my grandmother's foot mysteriously pressed the buzzer under the table. Swinging out of the kitchen door was James. White uniform, black polished shoes, trays of matzo ball soup, gefilte fish, lamb, vegetables, and desserts. James, always behind the scenes, taking orders, cooking, cleaning, and changing his uniform. With black cap and white gloves, James became my leftist-leaning grandparents' chauffeur. Grandma had purchased a small house intended for another member of the family, yet it became James's. James had several children, and somewhere along the way, his wife left with a few of their children, leaving James with the boys she chose not to take. On occasions, the sons would help at Grandma's house, raking leaves, and taking out the trash. One Passover, when I had already moved away and my grandfather had passed on, the family gathered for the annual Seder dinner. After the requisite service, my grandmother pressed the buzzer once, twice, and became increasingly aggravated as she pressed again. My recently married cousin and wife went to see what was going on in the kitchen. James was slumped on the small kitchen chair and leaning on the table. His left arm hurt. My cousins quickly ascertained a heart attack and were instructed to take James to the hospital as the party carried on. Upon James' admittance to the hospital, my cousins learned his name never was James. James was too sick to return to work. My grandmother hired other help. One night, my grandmother woke to two burglars. She must have yelled as they hit her over the nose with a lamp, and she passed out. They took her furs, her silver, and her jewelry. After returning from the hospital, Grandma calls James. She says she doesn't want to press charges against James's son, but she wants some of her belongings, and she'd be willing to pay. In so many words, James affirms that he'd do what he could.
Ooh, Judy, that was powerful. Well, all of these were, and I still can't listen to Jirogues without crying, so I can just imagine what it was like the day that you all sat together and did this. And I did want to just address something that Joe spoke about in terms of emotional healing, and a lot of my work has been on testimonial therapy and how the therapy itself is not only healing, but how it helps people put the stories together in their own lives, that they get to rethink it and restructure it in a way that makes sense. And this is particularly people suffering from trauma, but I would think, I mean, the way you even described telling this story, that might have also happened for you all. I mean, this way of the stories emerging through hearing others.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all came with, as Lucy had said, you know, we all came with stories in mind. The process of doing the workshop either changed what we were going to do or it helped shape what we were going to do. And then the large task of bringing things that maybe we had worked before or they were new material to squish it down into, 300 words was really quite the job for the day. But I think the emotional level to this work, there can't be more said about it as both positive and life-changing.
And I think also the evolution of the day that we spent together had to do with the intimacy that yeah. people were sharing. The more intimate you heard from someone else, the more you dug deep in yourself.
We have been listening today to Joe Lambert from the Center for Digital Storytelling, Judy Goldberg, Executive Director of Youth Media Project, and Lucy Moore. I would really encourage people to go and listen to so many of these stories. They're incredibly powerful. And to stay tuned for Youth Media Project that really wants to share and promote some of these other storytelling events for other people here in Santa Fe. Thank you all so much for being with us today on the Radio Cafe for Human Rights Day 2013.
Thank you, Zaylee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Zaylee, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.